Banking on the Extinction of Wild Tigers.
Think of tiger bone wine from farms as cubic zirconia, and wine made from the bones of wild tigers as flawless diamonds. That's the value differential. Some people are now investing in products from wild tigers. It's an investment. It's strictly an asset class. And if even a tiny fraction of China's 1.5 billion people seek wild tiger products as an investment asset, this could create a tsunami of demand that could quickly wipe out the last 3,000 wild tigers.
That's J.A. Mills. We talk with her about her book, Blood of the Tiger. It's a story about conspiracy, greed, and the battle to save the tiger. Then the story of a very special owl.
She would come and land on my shoulder and walk up my body and preen my beard with her beak. First thing in the morning when I opened the cage where she'd been spending the night, she would push up her face to be nuzzled.
That's Martin Windrow. He tells us about his companion owl, Mumble. His book is The Owl Who Liked Sitting on Caesar. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and on the web at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Riana. When Cecil the Lion was killed by trophy hunter Walter Palmer in July, the tragic incident put the killing of endangered species for profit on the global radar screen. Other reports have followed, most recently about the pangolin, an anteater-like creature that faces extinction because elites in Asia regard it as a delicacy. The wildlife trade threatens more well-known creatures, including one of the most iconic of them all, the wild tiger. Only 3,000 remain. Facing the end of the tiger in the wild, the Chinese government has been breeding tigers on farms. There are twice as many farm tigers as wild ones. Kept in appalling conditions, they're destined to be made into such products as tiger bone wine and other luxury goods for China's rising elite. My guest, wildlife trade investigator J.A. Mills, stumbled upon the existence of this so-called conservation program while investigating the farming of bears in China in 1991. Her memoir, Blood of the Tiger, recounts the story of this shocking program to raise tigers like livestock and how it threatens the existence of every last tiger in the wild as well. The book also describes the race to end the trade in tigers before it's too late. J.A. Mills has worked for the organization TRAFFIC, the World Wildlife Fund, Conservation International, and Save the Tiger Fund. She's now a consultant to the MacArthur Foundation and lives in Washington, D.C. J.A. Mills, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Francesca, thank you for having me.
This is a very powerful book, Blood of the Tiger. It's a story that I don't think has really been told all that much. It's the story of tiger conservation, but it really links together two different aspects of the tiger trade or the assaults on tigers, and that is the assaults on wild tigers and the existence and the growth of tiger farms. I had never heard of tiger farms before. And when did this start?
Well, it's interesting that you would say that because a lot of people have not heard of tiger farms, and they actually started back in the early 1990s in China as a response to the dwindling number of tigers that were available to the medicine manufacturers there who used their bones to make prescription drugs.
So the dwindling number of tigers in the wild, give us a sense of what are wild tiger populations at this time, and let's say, what has been the change over the last 20 years?
Well, I think that a lot of people, because they hear about elephant poaching and rhino poaching, believe that those animals are far worse off than wild tigers because tigers haven't been in the news lately. But in reality, there are more than 100,000 wild elephants left, more than 20,000 rhinos left in the wild, but only around 3,000 tigers. And At the time that China started farming tigers, there were probably around 7,000 in the wild. And over the years, we have seen those numbers of wild tigers, as I said, go consistently down until today's numbers at around 3,000, while we have seen the number of tigers on China's farms go in the opposite direction. And today there are as many as 6,000 tigers on these farms in China, so twice as many as remain in the wild.
I have to say, tears came to my eyes when you said that. I mean, the tiger is such an amazing creature. All the creatures are, of course, important. You know, I've been recently reading a book about cats, and one thing I didn't know about cats, and this is cats in general, not just house cats, is that there's a cultural component to what they do, that it's not just pure instinct. So farms, tigers being on farms, I mean, even if they were the most humane conditions imaginable, which they're not, what impact would that have on tigers as we know them?
Well, tigers are solitary animals in the wild, except when they come together to mate. And then, of course, when the mothers have cubs, they stay with their cubs for about 2.5 years. But on these farms, we see herds of tigers. A tiger farm is basically a feedlot for tigers where they're bred like cattle for their parts, and not to make medicine these days, but to make luxury goods such as tiger bone wine and tiger skin rugs. And I think it's really important that people understand that this is about wealth, not health. The traditional Chinese medicine industry made a decision many years ago that it wasn't in their best interest to use endangered species parts. And furthermore, recent polls in China show that the Chinese people don't want tiger products or tiger farming. In fact, they believe that this gives China a bad name in the global community. So this is about really a handful of investors who are poised to launch a multi-billion-dollar-a-year industry in selling these luxury products.
Who are these investors? You call them the dragon, is that right?
I refer in Blood of the Tiger to the dragon, and the dragon is actually a division of China's State Forestry Administration, which is in charge of wildlife protection. And I'm chuckling a little bit to myself because I think most people in the world would think that farming tigers does not equal wildlife protection. But there is a law on the books from 1986, the China's Wildlife Protection Law, which actually mandates the farming and consumption of endangered species such as tigers, rhinos, deer, bear. And this is why there are these industrial farms today for bears and tigers, and rhino farming is just starting up in China. This is a mandate by law that the State Forestry Administration is carrying out. And these guys, most of them are all around 40 years old, and they grew up with this mandate. As they were going to university and learning about wildlife conservation, this is what they learned, that this is how China does wildlife conservation. Of course, much has changed since that time, but this law remains the same. And there are people, Chinese people within China, who are valiantly trying to change this law. But at this time, it's still on the books.
So you first got into this around 1991. You were working on the issue of bears. As you say, you were investigating bear farms. And then you discovered a small group of tigers on a mink farm in China. First of all, who are you working for? Just briefly tell us that. And then tell us about the tigers you found.
Okay, I was doing an investigation of the bear trade across Asia for a group called TRAFFIC, which is the Wildlife Trade Monitoring Program of World Wildlife Fund and the World Conservation Union. And so China was just one of many countries where I was doing this investigation, but I had gone there specifically because I had heard a rumor that China was farming bears and somehow milking them while they're alive of the bile in their gallbladders, which is the medicinal ingredient for which bears are sought. And first of all, I never got to see the bile milking on that trip. I was very studiously kept away from seeing that. But I did learn that already at that time, China had thousands of bears on farms that were being milked of their bile. And along the way, to try to keep me from seeing this, my hosts took me to this rickety old mink farm where I saw a handful of tigers in rusty old school zoo cages. And the staff there proudly showed me a handwritten ledger where they were logging orders for tiger bone from medicine companies. I didn't know it at the time, but this was China's first tiger farm. And at that time, there were less than 100 farm tigers. And interestingly enough, 2 years later, China banned the trade in tiger bone and rhino horn, and yet the farms continue to grow to the point where today there are 6,000 tigers on these farms and they're still breeding. And this is in spite of a UN decision that tiger farming should stop.
We should just say in passing that milking bears isn't like milking cows.
No, they... Okay, to milk a bear, the gallbladder has to be surgically accessed. So basically, a tap is surgically created to allow bear farmers to access and milk the gallbladders of bears while they're living. And through most of their lives, they're kept in tiny cages that are sometimes not even big enough for these bears to stand up in or sit upright in. And there are today perhaps up to 40,000 bears on these farms. And I'll never forget the moment when I was in China in 1991 when my chief government host turned to me and said that China intended to farm bears and a long list of other animals like cows and pigs. So basically, that was their aim, and that is what is happening.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking about the tiger trade, about China's tiger farms, and the threat they pose to tigers in the wild. My guest is J.A. Mills, and her book is Blood of the Tiger. So the conditions are horrendous. China banned the trade of tiger bone, as you said, in 1993. You know, for those people who might say, well, you know, if we're losing these animals in the wild, then anything that can keep them alive for maybe future generations to reestablish them in the wild is a good thing. What's your comment on that attitude?
Okay, I have a number of comments to make on that. Firstly, you can take a tiger out of the wild, but you can't install wildness into a captive tiger. So it's simply not feasible to take these farmed animals and put them back in the wild. First of all, there has to be habitat and prey for them, and much of that is gone. But furthermore, tigers that have grown up around humans will seek humans the first time they get hungry. And this poses a danger to not just the released tiger, but to human communities nearby that tiger. I mean, it's a recipe for disaster, basically. I think the more important point is that tiger farming stimulates demand for tiger products, and that in turn stimulates poaching of wild tigers because products from wild tigers are considered superior. They're more prestigious, and they're exponentially more valuable. Think of tiger bone wine from farms as cubic zirconia and wine made from the bones of wild tigers as flawless diamonds. That's the value differential. Some people are now investing in products from wild tigers and also rhino horn and elephant ivory as they would invest in rare art. It's an investment. It's strictly an asset class. And if even a tiny fraction of China's 1.5 billion people seek wild tiger products as an investment asset, this could create a tsunami of demand that could quickly wipe out the last 3,000 wild tigers. And so it's very important that, number one, China stop farming tigers because it promises that tiger products will soon be available. And number two, it's very important that China keeps its ban in place and that it does not reopen tiger trade. Because, again, then all bets are off. We have no idea. No one has any idea what sort of demand that would create. And it would be foolish of us to gamble the last wild tigers on that venture that will just benefit a handful of investors. Again, this is not about the Chinese people crying out for tiger products. This is about a product looking for a market rather than a market looking for a product.
In fact, you say in the book, Judy Mills, you say in Blood of the Tiger that these investors are launching a billion-dollar industry that is banking on the extinction of not just wild tigers, but also of these other important animals.
Right. These people who are buying up tiger bones, elephant ivory, rhino horns as an investment see the value going up. One only has to read in the press now how valuable these objects are becoming. But if these animals go extinct in the wild, these investments will be priceless because there will be no more of these products from the wild.
So this is a desperate situation, not just a desperate situation, but one in which there are huge geopolitical currents swirling around it. What is the international community doing about this?
In 2007, the Treaty on International Trade in Endangered Species decided by consensus that tiger farming should stop and that tigers should not be bred for their parts and products. That, so far, has been ignored by China. There are a number of geopolitical issues swirling around that. One involves the United States, and many people don't know that here in the United States, we have at least as many tigers in captivity as China has on farms. Now, they're not on farms. They're in private zoos, private hands. Some are in legitimate zoos. And nobody knows exactly where all these animals are or what happens to them when they die. And I have heard repeatedly when I am at international conventions on this subject, why should China phase out its farms when the United States has at least as many tigers in captivity, and nobody's even keeping track of them? So there's a bit of a tit-for-tat going on. There's the other matter of tiger farming as the Chinese answer to conservation, and so it becomes sort of an East versus West issue. But where I have recently found reason for optimism is in China's suggestion in the last couple of weeks that it may finally, at last, ban ivory trade. And my sources in China tell me that this was precipitated by a visit from Prince William to China's President Xi Jinping. And the prince asked the president of China to ban ivory trade. And I think at that point it became clear to the president of China that there's really no upside for China in driving these species to extinction just for the sake of, you know, a handful of business people and a handful of investors and the consumers who might want to use these products. There's nothing, you know, absolutely necessary about this business or these products. So I believe that we could see China ban ivory. And there was a headline last week, too, saying that China was asking the United States to follow its lead and also ban trade in ivory. I would love to see China ban tiger farming and trade in perpetuity and ask the United States to follow its lead. And my dream is that when President Xi Jinping comes to the United States as president of China for the first time, that he and President Obama will discuss some sort of bilateral agreement that they will both, that both nations will find a way to phase out for all time trade in elephant ivory, rhino horn, tiger bone, and other endangered species products. I think that's the kind of agreement that could be a global game changer and allow these animals to survive and thrive.
So, yeah, international trade is much in the headlines these days because we're talking about the TPP. I just wonder, is there any way that this trade could actually be promoted, this terrible trade in tigers and in other endangered species, be protected somehow by the TPP? I mean, could these companies sue national governments for banning the trade in these products?
I think we're at a crossroads here, and I think that things could go either way. You know, if this whole mentality of domestication and consumption on an industrial scale prevails, then I think we could see all sorts of there could be lawsuits, there could be all sorts of proclamations of sovereignty, and many different reasons put forward, both legal and geopolitical, for really turning a whole array of endangered species into animals that would be no more than like cows and pigs, as the Chinese official once told me. But I think it's more likely that we'll see things go the other way. And I know for a fact that during these trade discussions, wildlife trade is one of the talking points. And that's in part thanks to President Obama's executive order on stopping illegal wildlife trade globally, not just because it's a conservation issue threatening the survival of these species in the wild, but also because profits from this trade are being used to fund terrorist activities and other sorts of crime that undermine national security in countries across the globe.
If the TPP goes down, does that mean that this trend would be weakened?
Because of the slaughter of elephants and rhinos in Africa at this time, I have the sense that this issue, if we can bring tigers back into the conversation, has taken on a life of its own that is being addressed on so many different levels that it's not going to go away. It is being addressed in bilateral discussions at the highest levels between China and the United States. And it's being discussed here in the United States at the state level, where a number of state governments have taken it upon themselves to pass bans on the trade in rhino and ivory. And we who advocate for tigers are always saying, oh, wait a minute, what about tigers? It's the same scenario, the same threat. And I feel that with the tigers injected into that conversation, that we all have a reason for optimism. And one of the things that I would encourage your listeners to do is speak out in whatever way they can. If it's just talking to a friend, a neighbor, a colleague via Twitter, Facebook, or even sending an email to the White House, which is very easy to do, to say, hey, what about tigers? And isn't this the time, isn't this the opportunity we can have to stop this trade once and for all? Because if we stop this trade, we can then have the time we need and the resources we need to focus on wild tigers and what they need to survive and thrive where they are today. We don't have to do anything fancy like, release captive tigers and hope that they won't eat humans in their vicinity, try to teach them how to hunt. We can just focus on keeping these last 3,000 wild tigers in place, safe, with plenty of prey to eat and the security they need. And then I think that we can rest assured that future generations will be able to see what is the most magnificent animal on the planet. And I think anybody who has ever seen one in the wild would agree with me.
I want to go a little bit more into what people can do. You give a list of resources. in your book, J.A. Mills, Blood of the Tiger, A Story of Conspiracy, Greed, and the Battle to Save a Magnificent Species. But before we do that, just a couple of questions about the potential for success of these efforts. I mean, poaching is a real issue. Doesn't there need to be enough resources to stop poaching? I mean, is it just about laws, or what is it actually going to take to save the wild tiger population?
We need to focus on the demand side. There is an organization I admire very much called WildAid, and their slogan is, when the buying stops, the killing can too. And if the buying stops in China in particular, I think we will see the killing fall off because there won't be a market for these things. There was a short time back in the mid-1990s when there were bans on trade in tiger products, rhino horn, and elephant ivory that were enforced, in place and enforced, and we saw these animals come back in the wild very quickly.
So are there some votes right now? Are there some issues or some ways that people, other than talking to friends or going onto social media, which of course are very important because it's about building a general movement, but are there some specific issues that people can pick up the phone right now or write a letter about?
I think the most powerful thing people can do is to contact their government officials, whether they be state, national, their favorite wildlife organization, and say, number one, what about tigers? Please put them in the mix with all the discussions about elephants and rhinos because it's all the same issue. And let's address these things together. With regard to the White House, whitehouse.gov, anybody can send an email. And if there are enough emails about a given subject, that subject will find its way into the White House. It could change everything.
And one of the things you talk about in the book are, you know, some of the ways that the conservation groups have not been helpful in this whole struggle. What do the conservation groups have to do to change their perspective to really be better, not just on tigers, but on the whole, you know, the next tiger, the next issue?
Well, I think, you know, it seems to me that all the breaking news has to do with species that are endangered by consumption in China. And now that's not, certainly there are species that are endangered by other things, but right now China is the focus. And many NGOs are afraid to speak up about China's consumption because there's a lot of blowback, and some of them have been threatened with being kicked out of China if they continue to speak up. But I think that there are ways that this issue can be addressed other than just silence. I think these organizations need to raise their voices again, because if we lose wild tigers, people are going to ask them where they were and why they were silent. So I think it's very important that they, you know, muster courage to stand up to China on these issues and to really look at what's going on in China. You know, this is about one ministry, the State Forestry Administration, that is married to a very old law that a number of Chinese would like to see changed. And a majority of Chinese people would like to see trade in these species banned. I think it's very important to look at that and try to find a way to play to that and to play to the fact that China does not want to be branded as
the destroyer.
The nation that one of my colleagues at WildAid, you know, asks whether brand China will be extinction. When I talk about demand from China, I'm talking about a demand that right now is very small. That demand is being stimulated by these people who have a vested interest in reopening tiger trade, reopening rhino horn trade, and reopening ivory trade. So basically, you know, we have a demand that already shrunk and continues to diminish, and then we have a handful of people in the government and a handful of vested interest in the private sector who are actively trying to regrow this demand that's already dying.
China is rife with corruption. Even if it if the trade were banned, do you think that China would be able to enforce that brand, given the kind of endemic corruption in the system?
When China wanted to stop panda poaching, because pandas are only found in China, it became a capital offense. People who poached pandas were executed, and their families had to buy the bullets with which they were executed. Now, I believe the death penalty for panda poaching is no longer in place, but people do go to prison for a very long time for panda poaching. And these strict penalties virtually stopped panda poaching. China can stop this trade if it wants to. If it becomes a priority for President Xi Jinping, it will stop. In the same way, after Prince William visited China, President Xi Jinping said to the State Forestry Administration, we have to do more to stop elephant poaching. And as a result of that, we're now hearing China talk about banning ivory trade for all time.
Well, that's ending on a hopeful note. This book, J.A. Mills, Judy Mills, is so important. Blood of the Tiger, a story of conspiracy, greed, and the battle to save a magnificent species. I want to mention that we got to the issues, but not to the stories. And our listeners will have to read the book to get those stories. They are just amazing. I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Francesca, thank you so much for your interest in the book and in tigers.
J.A. Mills. Go to writersvoice.net for a web-only extra with J.A. Mills about the impact of climate change on the wild tiger. Next up, an owl called Mumble. Stay tuned after the break.
Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forest of the night. What immortal hand or eye can frame thy fearful symmetry? In what distant deeps or skies burst the fire of thine eyes? On what wings dare he aspire? What the hand dare seize afire?
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Wild animals should never be made into pets, but some birds are raised for that purpose by domestic breeders. Back when he was a much younger man, my guest, military historian Martin Windrow, decided to adopt an owl he named Mumble. Raising her from chickhood, they lived together for 15 years in what can only be described as a pair bond. His poignant memoir, The Owl Who Likes Sitting on Caesar, tells the story of their unlikely friendship and inspires the reader to consider the affective bonds that tie humans to other creatures in the animal kingdom. Martin Windrow's foray into owning owls did not begin with Mumble, but with a far more fearsome bird named Wellington.
It was the only name for him. He had a really obstinate personality and a glaring face and a little hooked beak. Wellington, for sure.
And so you can tell the difference with your next owl, and that was Mumble. Mumble is the subject of this book, The Owl Who Liked Sitting on Caesar. Tell us about Mumble, and how did you find her?
Well, I went through the legal route. Over here in Britain, all hunting birds, hawks, falcons, and owls included, are heavily protected by law. You're not allowed to take them from the wild. Not that I would ever have been tempted, of course. It would always be, to me, an act of shocking cruelty to capture a wild bird and put it in a cage. And it's heavily illegal. But there are licensed breeders of birds who basically raise birds over generations and generations from injured ones which are brought in by vets and so forth. So I got on to my brother, who is the guy who knows everybody, and told him that maybe a tawny owl. I'd heard that tawny owls make good pets, that they seem happy, and I'd met one who was. So he got onto a breeder and found pair of breeding tawny owls, and I literally reserved an egg from the next litter, which was going to be laid the following spring. And in due course, I got a phone call telling me that my egg had been laid and was being hatched in an incubator, so that the first thing she saw when she lifted the lid of the egg was a human being rather than another owl. Then I heard that she'd hatched and was being raised for the first month or so by the breeder's small son. And then in late May, I got another phone call saying, fine, she's ready to be picked up. And she was, I drove down to my brother's farm, and we met. That was it.
And it was very nearly love at first sight, wasn't it?
Well, it was on my part. I mean, I'd never had a pet. I knew nothing about ornithology. It was only because of having spent some enforced time down at my brother's place, and so being able to pay attention to his couple of hunting birds that he had that he used to train and fly, that was it. I had no previous experience in this, so I didn't really know what to expect. And I walked into the room, and there she was, and there I was, and we looked at one another, and I thought, Stroop, that's the cutest thing I've ever seen in my life. And she looked at me, and she squeaked and jumped up on my shoulder, and that was it for 15 years.
Now, before we go more deeply into the story of Mumble herself, and before we do that, tell us, why did you call her Mumble?
Well, because she did. She talked to herself quietly but persistently most of the time, and to me when I was around.
So now tell us about the tawny owl. You say that, you know, they're actually a very ancient breed, 3 million years old or somewhere
around
that?
Oh, more, yeah. Say 50 million. The ornithology of this is, the paleontology is tricky and complex, but simply because bird bones are so fragile that they don't last into the fossil record very much. But we know that there were owls 50 million years ago, and we know that by 3.5 million years ago, there was something which was definitely a tawny owl. The Latin name for the breed is Strix aluco, and bones, fossilized bones, have been found from 3.5 million-year-old deposits. Well, 3.5 million years ago, there were no humans around. There was sort of something about 4 feet high and hairy that was just getting to grips with walking on its back legs, but it certainly wasn't a human. So they are much older than us.
And so tell us a little bit about owls. I mean, you really make some distinctions between those that are daytime and those are nighttime. And I think, you know, probably most of us have been laboring under the notion that all owls are nighttime creatures, but that's not true.
Mm. No, a lot are, but there are others whose working day, as it were, starts in the sort of late afternoon, I mean, many hours before sunset. The tawny is one who's kind of rigid in its habits. You don't have tawny owls in America, so it's a little hard to describe this, except that it's the simplest way of describing the look of a tawny is it's your classic cartoon owl. Big eyes and a head like a ball of fluff set on top of a bigger ball of fluff. That's it. And tawnies are a woodland bird. They have short, broad wings because they have to be able to maneuver at speed around a lot of obstacles, and they are very nocturnal. They don't wake up until sunset, and they make sure that they're hidden in a woodland perch by sunrise. The only exception with tawnies is when they're feeding a young family, when they've got owlets in the nest yelling to be fed the whole time, then often the male bird has to stay up in the morning and keep hunting. And but those are about the only occasions we'll see them flying in daylight. Much more visible in Britain, actually, is a barn owl. These are much more flexible in their hours of activity, and for that reason they get, you know, people make TV documentaries about them all the time, because they are quite often seen flying in daylight. But no, the tawny is a very secretive creature. It lives tucked up in the trees. It's the tawny's call that is the classic owl call that we've all heard, you know, so-called tu-whit-tu-woo. That's a tawny.
Although you say it really should be tu-whoo-tu-whit.
Yeah, if you're going to be picky about it, it should be tu-whoo-tu-whit, yes. And it's, when you hear that, it's quite often two owls having a conversation.
No.
They are, over the centuries, because they hang around they live in thick woodland, or often in old ruined buildings, and in Europe, often in church towers, that's where they get the kind of spooky reputation from, which is ludicrous, but over, you know, thousands of years, people have thought that their call was spooky and to do with this. If any creature that hangs around entirely in the hours of darkness and hangs around churchyards and things has got to be spooky, right? Not so, of course. I'm a firm defender of tawny owls as being an altogether positive companion.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Martin Windrow about his memoir of living with an owl for 15 years. It's called The Owl Who Liked Sitting on Caesar. The Caesar in question was a bust of Caesar Germanicus, Mumble the Owl's favorite perch.
Right, and in fact, you have a very interesting section in the book about owls in general, how they have been related to by people in myth and folklore. It differs in different places.
Yeah.
Give us a little oversight about that.
Well, in the West, in Europe, because they weren't often seen and because they hung around in church towers, and because when they are spotted by daylight, they stay very still, they got given this reputation for being, if not spooky, then at least wise. They sort of, you know, with the big round eyes, people thought that looked like a guy wearing spectacles. And if they sit still, not doing anything or saying anything and wearing spectacles, oh, people made the association with schoolmasters or like that. And anyway, people assume that any creature that sits still and keeps its eyes open and says nothing is doing a lot of thinking. That was the kind of reputation they had. That, at the same time, in parallel, people thinking that when you heard an owl call at night, it was a doomy warning that somebody was going in the house was going to die or like that. But equally, in other parts of the world, they've had a completely different reputation. For instance, in the Southwest United States, the Native American peoples had great respect for them as both wise and as being silent, stealthy hunters by night. Apache war caps, warriors' war caps, were bedecked with owl feathers, and the Plains Indians peoples used owl feathers along with eagle and hawk feathers to decorate their costumes and their weapons. Funnily enough, in India, East India, in Asia, they have a folkloric tradition of being stupid. And then you go a dozen miles north and the plains of Mongolia, and the horse nomad peoples of Asia have always revered them as repositories of wisdom, symbols of wisdom. So it changes. But in all parts of the world, the fact that they are such masters of the night when we are blind and helpless has meant that they were always impressive, however way that was interpreted, whether for good or for bad.
They were actually seen as familiar, witches' familiars.
Yeah, that was a bad incident, yes. It was natural, wasn't it? and the creature of the night. You know, they've got to be in league with the devil, according to some people.
You call them cats that fly.
Well, that was my experience of living with one in a not very large high-rise apartment. I don't know if you've ever had a kitten in the house, but if you imagine what that's like, but a kitten which is teaching itself to fly at the same time. So enormously amusing and great fun, but not without expense. She did cost me a certain amount in breakages.
And also you had to cover a lot of furniture with plastic.
Yeah.
Because one thing they don't have is a kitty litter box.
Yes, there's no such thing as that. I mean, of course, I provided a tray and the perch, which I wished she would sit on, but I always go wherever they damn well please and whenever. And so although I did try and work out when things were going to get a bit disgusting, it was necessary to have a lot of newspapers and plastic around the place. Of course, my friends thought I was insane for putting up with this, but I found it quite hard to explain to them the rewards, which were considerable.
Right. And Martin Windrow, in this book, The Owl Who Likes Sitting on Caesar, you really paint such a charming portrait of this owl. You almost pair bonded, or maybe it's not almost. You did pair bond. Talk about the bond that you had between you and how she treated you.
I'm very hesitant to try and put this into words, because I don't want to be over-sentimental or over-interpret. But I was forced to recognize that it did happen and it did exist. I was expecting that I would be able to tame this bird, right? That she would learn to come to my hand for food and therefore would get used to, me handling her, stroking her, and that she would lose fear of me. And that, I wouldn't say that happened, that was from the very first day that I took her home. She was doing that. We had that unfearful relationship. What I hadn't anticipated, and which I resisted until the evidence was undeniable, was that over and above that relationship of me being, if you like, mama, I was doing the feeding, she would come to me of her own free will without me sort of whistling or trying to attract her attention. And she seemed to enjoy being handled. She would come and land on my shoulder and walk up my body and preen my beard with her beak. She would, first thing in the morning when I opened the cage where she'd been spending the night, she would push up her face to be nuzzled. She liked being stroked, particularly on the top of her head and between her eyes. Again, this is a kind of a cat-like thing. I don't know if you've ever known a cat that does that head bonking thing when they shove their head against yours and twist their head and rub. It was just like that. She was coming for the pleasure of being touched. Now, at the same time as this, as she grew up, I mean, by the time she'd finished her first year and was fully grown and fully flying, she was, by then, a completely one-man bird. She would attack furiously any other human being that came into the flat. Whereas when she'd been just a ball of fluff, she was completely tame with everybody. But somehow, during the growing up process, she turned. And then it became quite impossible for me to have anybody else in the same room, or there would be blood. So, asked about pair bonding. Well, I can only assume, and this is pure guesswork, I can only assume that initially in the pair bond between us, she saw me as the mother, the provider of food. But as she grew up, she must have seen me in the role kind of as the role she would have with her mate later on, because although they're not a social bird, they don't live near to other owls. They are a solitary hunting bird. They do form a pair bond, and it seems to last for life. So I can only assume that that was what's happening.
Yes, and you had a cage for her, a large cage outside on your balcony, and wild tawny owls would come in, you know, and kind of notice her and come close to the cage.
Oh, sure.
And she did not like that at all. Why do you think she... Was she not interested in them because she had already bonded with you, or...?
She'd already got a territory. I think that was it. Yes, I guess the bond with me must have had something to do with it. I know that she always react on the occasions, and they were relatively rare, when a wild tawny owl came around to see her, with, I can only imagine, romance in mind, her reaction was always entirely territorial, furious, threatening, which could get kind of exciting if I just happened to be in the cage with her at the time when it happened. This was very noticeable in the first couple of years when, yes, she was spending some time in a cage on the balcony in a high-rise flat. I noticed it less later on when she was 3 years older, so we moved down. I bought a small house down in the country here and built her a big aviary in the garden so she could have a much more natural surroundings, even when she wasn't loose with me. And then there were occasions when she was visited by hopeful suitors, but equally, the response was always hostile. It was always, get off my land, you know?
So her life really changed, and how did she adjust to being outside and in the country, although I know she could go inside as well?
It took her a while, which isn't surprising, because if you consider the complete change in her surroundings, for the first three sort of formative years of her life, she'd been living with me in this high-rise apartment in South London. There were big windows, and she had a wide view from her cage on the balcony, but still what she was looking at was a series of roofscapes, right? And another tall high-rise. Night and day, she was seven floors above it. So she had things to look at a distance. She had things to look at close up, i.e. me, and the insides of the flat where she had her own little routines to keep her amused. But when we went down to the countryside and I built her this aviary, which was, quite large, instantly at her own level and at all distances from close up to far away, she had greenery and life, small things, everything from insects up to cows in the next field. And that took her a while to adjust, I know. She was pretty frisky. I think it took her probably about 3 weeks before she'd filed all this new information away. I mean, she was, it must have been a hell of a shock. She was getting new stimuli every minute she was awake. She coped. She adjusted to the whole new life and was soon, quite contented again.
And happily hunting rodents that had the misfortune to go.
That was a new plus, yes. That was a new plus. It was a big aviary, and I didn't, floor it in any way. I just let the grass and the weeds grow up inside the aviary the same way they were growing up outside the wire. And I did discover that quite often foolish local rodents would try and take a shortcut through the floor of the aviary, and they didn't last long. And that amazed me because, of course, nobody had taught her to hunt. She'd had no parental example since she was raised in an incubator. And I was astonished, but there is no doubt about it. She knew innately exactly how to locate, zero in on, and pounce. And she was pretty pleased with herself, I have to say.
Now, the way she died was rather strange, actually. I mean, she died, I guess you could call, of natural causes, but
yeah.
perhaps not entirely natural.
Yeah. I was furious about that at the time. Yes, it was natural causes, in that there was no sickness or violence involved. She had a heart attack. Now, hunting birds, who they're exclusively carnivores, they have a high-protein diet. Hunting birds in captivity live almost exclusively on dead, day-old chickens, which are a very high-protein food. So they are, in their later years, prone to heart attacks. And at 15, she was a pretty old bird by the average. She was by far from being as old as they can live, but she was already at least three times the average lifespan of a tawny owl in the wild. So I've got to assume that she was, like middle-aged and out of shape. And someone in the night, some person, broke into the aviary. And from the way that I found her dead in there, I could only assume that she'd reacted in the way which was quite natural to her, which would be to burst into panic flight and fly very fast at them and then around the aviary. And she must have just had a heart attack, because there wasn't a mark on her, and she was just lying in the middle of a bunch of flowers in wings spread in full flying mode. I was pretty angry about that.
Yeah, that was sad. So after she died, you must have really taken some time to process what your relationship meant to you, and of course during the writing of this book. What were the lessons of this profound human-avian friendship? What did it maybe teach you about yourself or being human and our relationship to non-human beings?
Before owls, I hadn't had any pets. Animals hadn't really figured in my life. I suppose I am trying hard not to sound too pretentious here. It confronted me with the fact that all sentient animals are part of the same thing, the same creation. We have a bond. We have a relationship, however you define it. There was nothing magic about this, an individual owl. It was just one man and one bird in each other's company, enforcedly, for years. And it did make me look beyond that. You know, it's logical. If this relationship existed, then we have potentially a relationship with all other living things. And that, as a fairly gruff old guy who has been a military historian for my living all my life, that was quite a revelation. And it did change my thinking. Here's Francesca.
Martin Windrow. Go to writersvoice.net for photos of Mumble the Owl. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight into your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Our webmaster is Bill Way.